Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we got a pretty good show for you. Let's start with this one. I kind of like this one. President Obama's all-time approval hit a great new low. All right? So, yeah. It's always good to be a frequent. This is from the Mediaite. Mediaite.
I don't know that site.
Yeah, they kind of funny.
Is that new to us?
No, they're kind of my Facebook friends.
Oh.
But anyway.
Along with 3,000 other.
Yeah. Well, not really. I'm losing a lot because I can't stand Obama, and half the people I was friends with loved Obama.
Oh.
And love Obama. They get off, but they masturbate over Obama. So it's like, you know.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
That's a little disgusting.
No, they really do.
There's some serious
Obama stuff. People out there.
Well, you don't have to be disgusting.
Well, you know, it's true.
Well,
50 more friends tonight. Okay.
It's
always... Well, you don't like him. So
no, but I don't say things like
at all.
That.
You didn't even vote for him, so it's like, you know, forget about it. But I say things like that because I know it's true. It's always good to be a frequent record breaker. But not if the record is how little people actually like you. Well, President Obama has hit yet another record low approval rating. Former similar record lows in other polls for the last few months, this time from Quinnipiac. That's from Connecticut, folks. Okay, which marks Obama's approval numbers at 39%. Right.
Well, George Bush was down around 35, if I remember.
That's when he left the office, not when he was in office. But contrast. George W. Bush at this time as president sunk to what was then an all-time low of 37%. Oh, okay, 2%. Obama's 2% higher. Well, Obama's net approval rating was just 4% at the start of October, only to jump down to minus 15 this week. Independents have disapproved of Obama's 63-30, and Republicans overwhelmingly disapproved by a 95-point margin. While Democrats still widely approve of Obama's performance, 79-14. I told you, they're getting off like crazy sexually over this guy. And whether or not it had to do with the you can keep your plan promise, that wasn't exactly how it sounded for the first time in the Quinnipiac poll, most people consider Obama untrustworthy and dishonest than believe he's an honest man. People still approve of his handling of global terrorism, but the majority disapprove of how he handled foreign policy in general, immigration, the budget, healthcare, and general economy. And that's not even touching the real, really bad numbers about Obamacare. Glenn Beck predicted that at the end of Obama's presidency, he'd be lucky to break 20% if the trend continues. He might end up being right about that. You can read the rest of the full poll here. So let's check the full poll. That'd be fun. Quinnipiac University poll on Obama's approval rating. Let's see. Today this poll is...
No, go down to the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Obama gets positive.
52-42% approval rating for handling terrorism and negative grades for handling other issues. 35-53% on foreign policy. 35-53% on immigration. 32-62% on federal budget. 36-60% on 59%. Okay, 38-59% on the economy. Affordable Care Act. Only 19% of American voters say the quality of care they and their families receive will improve in the next year because of the Affordable Care Act. Well, 43% say it will get worse, and 33% say ACA won't affect their health care. Right. That's good. I don't know where the hell I come up with that. But voters opposed the ACA 55% to 39%, with men opposed 59% to 37%, women opposed 51% to 41%. American voters are divided, 46% to 47%, on whether Obama knowingly deceived. Oh man, people are so stupid. The public, when he said people could keep their existing people, they're still idiots who believe that he didn't deceive them. You know what I mean? I mean, what is wrong with these people? American voters are divided 46% to 47%. Imagine that. People think that the existing health insurance plan, if they wished, they can still keep their plan. You people are stupid. Voters also support 73% to 20% extending the March 31st deadline for signing up for coverage without facing a penalty. President Obama's misstatement, if you like your president's health care, you can keep it, left a bad taste with people, with a lot of people. Nearly half the voters, 46%, think they knowingly deceived them. Only 46%. I mean, what the hell? People are so stupid. From November 6th to 11th, Quinnipiac University survey, 2,545 people, registered voters nationwide with a margin error of plus or minus 1.9 percentage points. Live interviews, call landlines, and cell phones. Quinnipiac University poll directed by Doug Schwartz, Ph.D., conducts public opinion in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Florida, Virginia, Iowa, Colorado, Ohio, and the nation as a public service and for research. But just so you know, all right, just so you know, do you approve or disapprove of the way Barack Obama is handling his job? Total approve was 39%, disapprove 54%. What do you think of that? Yeah. Let's see. Republicans say had only 6% approval. Democrats, idiots. Man, these Democrats are so brainwashed that 79%. Yeah.
If you looked at the
independents, well, wait a minute. Let me finish this. What? Democrats, okay, independents at 30%. Let's see, what's MA? Men, 37%. Women, 40%. Whites, 32%. Blacks, 75%, of course. Okay, and Hispanics, 41%.
If you turned that around if you looked at the same thing that the Quinnipiac poll during Bush's administration, you'd see the same numbers except reverse for Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
Republicans,
everybody loves Bush's, the incredible Bush. Yeah, it's amazing. It's totally great. I ask you to go to the site because there's a whole lot of interesting stuff here in this poll. And it tells you, it just goes to show you how stupid the American people really are. Just totally freaking incredibly insane brainwashed. Yeah, I mean, it's really a sick thing. Oh, anyway, but you know, aren't we all in some way, I guess? Of course, Quinnipiac is having a hard time contacting Facebook. I'm trying to get this thing. Isn't that weird? What's the problem there, Quinnipiac? There you go. Wonderful world. And, let's see. I got clobbered about five or 10 minutes ago, right before I came on here. I got spiked. Now, for some reason, I'm not responding. See. I don't know, folks. How to explain technology in this day and age. Coming. coming. I'm coming. Here we go. Yeah.
Buffer.
Yeah. Buffering.
It takes time.
It only takes time when we're on the air for some reason. It doesn't take that kind of time when you're on the time.
Hmm.
I'm convinced that we're being stupid.
I never see anything.
Huh?
Well, I don't go on Facebook, but any time you're on the air.
Because when I'm on the air, whenever I'm on the air, it's as though something is just trying to slow us down.
We should use another site.
I'm thinking about it. I'm
very unsatisfactory.
I'm almost thinking about getting off of Facebook altogether. I find it to be a fraud, you know. But hey, there we go. This is an interesting article that came up from. Did Feinstein really land her husband billions? That was interesting.
Really?
Yeah, turns out Feinstein's a crook. And I always knew she was a crook, but this one's kind of...
This is from WND, huh?
Yeah. And it says, the husband of Senator Feinstein, Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, stands to reap a windfall from an exclusive contract to set off billions of dollars of U.S. post office properties.
Oh, he's going to sell them off?
Yeah. But what windfall will be far short of the $950 million that flaming internet rumors have speculated? For months now, an exaggerated report has been circulating around the internet that Feinstein's husband, Richard Boom, won the federal contract to sell the U.S. Postal Service properties and will personally reap nearly $1 billion in commissions. The implication is that Feinstein used her position in Congress to help Boom land the government contract, thus joining her husband in his newfound spectacular wealth. The reality, however,
is
significantly different. It is true that in 2011, the Postal Service entered into an exclusive contract with CBR Group Inc. to sell out billions of dollars of post office properties. But CBR, the world's largest commercial real estate firm, is not owned by Boom, nor will he see direct income from the sale commission. Boom is merely the board chairman of the company, which actually employs over 22,000 people last year. And according to a March 2013 corporate report, Boom made a total of $157,000 last year for serving in that capacity. Petty cash.
Mm-hmm.
But the commissions on the post office sales will not directly line Boom's pocket. Well, that's disappointing. It is true, however, that Boom is also a heavy investor in the company. His investment firm owning over 15 million shares in CBR, yet this amounts only to 4.6% of the corporation. A major deal like landing the U.S. via contract will certainly profit CBR and thus its shareholders, including Bloom. But of the many millions of dollars CBRE may receive in commissions on the sale of the old post office, the profits will be divided among the various expenses, and so on and so forth. So Senator Feinstein is not involved with it, and does not discuss any of her business decisions, she said.
Hmm.
Her husband's holdings are his separate personal property. Senator Feinstein's assets are held in a blind trust. That arrangement has been in place since before she became the Senate in 1992. So, of course, she's a virgin, and she is completely held unaccountable. Yes. Okay. Now, here's something interesting, too. Record high, 91.5 million people are not included in the labor force. Yeah, one way. Over.
Is this from the Daily Caller?
Yeah.
A record high of 91,541,000 Americans did not participate in the labor force this October. Well, you keep jumping. According to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 932,000 people dropped out of the labor force last month from a total of
906,609,000
in September.
That's a big difference. Yes. 900 million.
To 91,541,000 in October. The BLS defines a person not in the labor force as age 16 and older who are not employed and not considered to be unemployed as they have not looked for work in the past 4 weeks prior to the survey. The labor force participation rate for all employed and unemployed people in accordance with the decline also hit a record low at 62.8%. When President Obama took office in January 2009, the labor force petition rate was 65.7%. From January 2009 to October 2013, more than 11 million people have dropped out of the labor force. What? From 80,507,000 to October's 91,541,000. The economic blog Zero Hedge notes that at the current rate, the number of people not participating in the labor force could exceed those working in about 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how many jobs have
gone. Yeah, that's the amazing Obama economy.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal terror charges filed against Obama.
Oh, how about
I thought this
that?
Is interesting, yeah.
From the same site, WND Politics.
Yeah, this is a right-wing blog, but he's got a lot of interesting stuff. How to sell it?
Jerome Corsi.
Yeah, criminal terror charges. Several prominent media sources in Egypt are now reporting that Egyptian lawyers have filed criminal terrorism charges in the International Criminal Court against President Obama, in addition to the criminal terrorism charges previously held in the Egyptian court against the president's half-brother, Malik Obama.
Who?
Yeah, well, Malik has been a...
He's a terrorist.
He's been funding the terrorist groups by Obama's money. Okay, Obama, U.S. money has been going through Malik Obama, and he's been funding these terrorist brotherhood. Now, that's kind of crap. Malik Obama is quickly becoming a person of interest in Egypt for his alleged management of funds for a terrorist organization based in neighboring Sudan. A group of Egyptian lawyers, meanwhile, have charged President Obama with crimes against humanity for his support of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Charges come as a criminal trial against former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi is scheduled to begin in Egypt in January 2014. And Morsi facing charges that he supported the Muslim Brotherhood in acts of violence directed against the Egyptian people. Well, President Obama is likely to be a subject of Morsi's criminal trial because of evidence that Obama administration used the U.S. Embassy in Cairo to provide direct financial support to key Muslim Brotherhood political operatives with the full knowledge and complicity of the Morsi government. A criminal complaint against filed at ICC. The Egyptian newspaper El Watan has reported a group of Egyptian lawyers has submitted a complaint to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, charging Obama with backing the group that incited widespread violence in Egypt both before and after what is known as Egypt as the June 30th revolution. The Egyptian army coup d'etat removed Morsi from the presidency on July 3rd. At first reported by CBN News, the complaint names several top-ranking Muslim Brotherhood leaders, beginning with the head of the organization, Mohammed Badi, as well as Mohammed complaint charged that Obama coordinated, incited, and assisted the armed elements of the Muslim Brotherhood in the commission of crimes against humanity in the period from March 7th through August 18th in Egypt. The complaint specifies that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt persecuted the country's Christian minority, including the torturing, destruction, and plundering of some 85 Christian churches. The regime also scapegoated the Christian Copts as Egypt's as in Egypt for
Copts.
Their support
Copts
in support of their June 30 revolution and removal of Morsi from the presidency, the complaint asserted.
The complaint alleges Muslim Brotherhood incitement against the Copts resulted in the murder of a 10-year-old girl who was shot and killed as she walked back from Bible class. The murder of a young Coptic priest who was shot in front of his church in the Egyptian Sinai with his body found mutilated and beheaded, and the murder of two girls, aged 8 and 12, who were riddled with bullets as they attended a Christian church wedding. The complaint further alleges that since the Muslim Brotherhood denounced the Copts, entire towns and villages have been emptied of Christians. More than 100 Christian families, for example, have been driven from the northern Sinai city of El Arish. Muslim Brotherhood supporters are accused of extorting Copts by making them pay tribute money to Islamic overlords, while those unwilling to pay were attacked, with their wives and children being beaten or kidnapped. In a YouTube video, CBN News contributor Raymond Ibrahim reported from Egypt details of alleged atrocities committed by Muslim Brotherhood members against Christians in Egypt. That must be a little video there. Why don't we play that? Let's see what they have to say.
International Criminal Court charging the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, with crimes against humanity. CBN contributing correspondent Raymond Ibrahim is the first to break the story in the U.S. On his blog page at cbnnews.com, he cites the Egyptian newspaper El Watan, which published the complaint against President Obama. The complaint accused the President with being an accessory to the Muslim Brotherhood, which incited violence across Egypt earlier this year. Ibrahim reports that the complaint mentions Obama and several Brotherhood members in name. It adds, quote, Obama cooperated, incited, and assisted the armed elements of the Muslim Brotherhood in the commission of crimes against humanity in the Arab Republic of Egypt. CBN News contributor Raymond Ibrahim joins us now by Skype. Raymond, the complaint says the president incited and assisted the Muslim Brotherhood in its crimes. In what way did he do this?
Primarily, the accusation is made that he did it by his funding them monetarily, including with billions of dollars. And in fact, since this time, you know, the plot is thickening, and we can talk about that later, but now there's even information that there's recordings of Morsi talking with Al-Qaeda, and somehow all this is involved with the U.S. and so forth. But back to this particular point, as the Al-Qaeda thing is still developing, the main complaint is that he's an accessory and that he by supporting the Brotherhood, he is supporting whatever they do. And so he gave a lot of money to them, which enabled them. Most people don't know that it's not so much that people love the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but rather the Muslim Brotherhood pays and buys people off, including thugs who go around burning churches, who go around terrorizing, just people like that who will do it just for pay. And so you can see how this money being funneled really through the Obama administration to the Muslim Brotherhood is ultimately manifesting itself in all these crimes against humanity that the Muslim Brotherhood committed in recent months.
And specifically to those crimes, Raymond, they are listed as torture, rape, kidnapping. Give us some examples, specific examples of how the Brotherhood committed these crimes against ordinary citizens.
Certainly. This really started back when Morsi was still president, back in December, last December, and you know, people were rising up against him back then in protests and mass demonstrations, and one of the most notable is in front of what's called the Tahdiyah Palace, which is really the palace of the president. There were a lot of protesters there, and it turned out that they got attacked. They were taken to torture rooms, literally, and we have evidence of this in pictures, and tortured, and people were beaten and just sliced up. And this is one of the main well-documented ones, because all the Brotherhood supporters at the time had incited everyone, saying, anyone who rises up against Morsi, we're going to do this to him. And that's exactly what they did. And then you fast forward more recently after the ousting of Morsi, and you'll recall there was those sit-ins, or at least that's how they were described by the media, the mainstream media so-called, as sit-ins in Rabaa al-Adawiyya, for example, where you had all the Brotherhood was sitting there. And in fact, after it was clear, they found out people were actually killed there, slaughtered. They found mass graves of bodies of people who tried to escape. One man, there's a video of him, pictures of him, they chopped his finger off according to Sharia law because they accused him of stealing. There was the infamous sex fatwa in that context. In order to satisfy the men who were holding that ground, they could now have sex, illegal sex, including through rape with women. And all this is documented, and we have it. And so this is, as you can see right there, and just in those little particular anecdotes, various crimes against humanity.
You say in your article, one need only look to the fate of Egypt's Christian minority to see numerous examples of crimes against humanity. How did the Muslim Brotherhood target and persecute Christians?
Immediately after the ousting of Morsi, the top Brotherhood leadership, beginning with the general guy, who's really the supreme leader, Mohammed Badia, the top guy, as well as people like Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who's like even really the spiritual father of the Muslim Brotherhood, and any other Safwat Hagazi, these are names most people are not familiar with, but these are top Brotherhood leaders. They all came up and publicly condemned the Coptic Pope and the Coptic Church, saying that they played a great role in getting Morsi kicked out. And it's true, the Coptic Church, just like Al-Azhar and so many organizations, were supportive of the people's will and were supportive of the military's movement of getting rid of Morsi. But they were scapegoated because they're the other, they're the infidel, they're the non-Muslim, so they're an easy target. And the Brotherhood did this, and immediately, if you look at the International Criminal Court criteria of what class is classified, there's maybe, I don't know, half a dozen or more, about a dozen categories, persecution of a minority, killing, torture, abduction, sexual abuse, and if you just look at the plight of the Copts since what happened to them, every single one of those categories is easily met. We know up to some, at least 80 or so churches, some very ancient, have been destroyed and burned and attacked, some transformed into mosques and so forth, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much, people have been dislocated, kicked out of whole villages. They started, the Muslim Brotherhood and supporters were in Upper Egypt, in the remote areas, exacting jizya tax from Christians. Christians are being abducted, held hostage for money, and then sometimes given back, sometimes murdered, including children. And all this is being done in the context of widespread anger at Christians because of the ousting of the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, was supported by the Obama administration. And then one final important point is, speaking of money and Obama, so we know he was supportive by giving the Brotherhood money, but now that the Brotherhood has been ousted, what has he done? He's now withheld money from Egypt. So he's punishing now all of Egypt because the Brotherhood, who have done all these things, are out, and he's doing this monetarily, once again, pulling the money out.
And this persecution that you speak of is still going on right now, isn't it?
It most certainly. It's ongoing, and, you know, it's becomes, it's just, I mean, 85 churches. Imagine if, you know, 85 mosques were attacked, how this would be all over the media, and just all these politicians would be condemning it, chief among them Obama, and yet you get nothing but silence, and they're just being scapegoated for the Brotherhood, who is being supported. And a final tie of how we know the Obama administration is so supportive of the Brotherhood is if you look at the actions of top U.S. officials, starting with the ambassador to Egypt, Ann Patterson, who was one of the most hated figures in Egypt because of her so blatantly obvious pro-Brotherhood politics. And she actually, when people were going to revolt in the revolution, she tried to stop the Copts, saying, no, don't go out, because, and they were the ones who were already suffering, and she tried to get all kinds of other Egyptians not to go out. And then you have John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Hillary Clinton, all these people, by their words and deeds, have shown their support for the Muslim Brotherhood. It's very clear they want them either back in power or at least not being tried, and I believe they don't want them to be tried because a lot of ugly secrets above and beyond what we're discussing will be revealed.
And why did the president align himself with the Muslim Brotherhood in the first place?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is a very old organization. It has its tentacles everywhere. Another new report just came out talking about all the various Muslim Brotherhood operatives in America, including a lot of them are centered around D.C. The accusation is well known that they're Muslim Brotherhood members, sympathizers, and so forth in the White House, all around the government, And so, you know, that's one aspect to it. The other aspect, of course, is just, you know, real politics. And there's this belief that the Muslim Brotherhood is, you know, a strong player. And so the U.S. wants to work with it, wants to support it in order that the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, theoretically gives the U.S. what it wants, which, of course, is ridiculous for anyone to think that it will eventually. I mean, in the short term, it's one thing, but in the long term, the Muslim Brotherhood has a radical Islamic worldview and agenda, which is just as bad for the United States as it is for COP.
And one thing, having just returned from Egypt a few weeks ago, the anger against the White House, and in particular President Obama, is palpable, not just among Coptic Christians, but also secular Muslims. Can you help us understand why a large segment of the Egyptian society is angry at President Obama? Not necessarily the United States and Americans, but the White House, and in particular this administration.
You're absolutely correct. And the reason this anger is so widespread is because in Egypt, all these things that we're talking about are well known. People there are watching the news or following events. They're seeing the evidence with their own eyes, videotapes and discussions that make unequivocally clear that the Obama administration, you know, has the back of the Muslim Brotherhood, to put it colloquially. And it's hard for Americans to comprehend this because here, based on the so-called mainstream media, you don't know this. You have no idea. You can't begin to imagine that this is going on. So it's, they are feeling it. They are experiencing the repercussions of the Obama administration's support for the Muslim Brotherhood, and they know it's happening. I mean, during the June 30 revolution, they had placards and signs all over the place saying, Obama, stop supporting terrorism, and things of this nature. And, you know, but your average American, because if they're following the mainstream media, they'll have no clue of any of this.
And, in fact, Christians that I spoke to, prominent Christian leaders, put the blame of the attacks on the Christians squarely on the president.
Exactly. Because without him, the Muslim Brotherhood would not have the power or influence that it does. And so you can see he's an accessory. If someone is killing and destroying you and they have influence and they have money and they're able to reach out and mobilize and so forth, then you find out behind them is an a president or an entity or whatever that supports them monetarily and politically. Politically, we've seen it simply with the fact that because of this ousting of Morsi, which was in response to up to 40 million Egyptians marching in the streets, which is a popular revolution, now the Obama administration is withholding hundreds of millions of dollars. Whereas when Morsi was in power, this man was Islamizing Egypt and persecuting Christians and so forth. The U.S. was giving him billions of dollars. And now, as I'm saying, another very important development that you're not going to hear anything about or so far in the Western media is this, you know, the Morsi, Ayman Zawahiri al-Qaeda tie with evidence of them speaking on the phone, making deals. And you know, in the background is America, and that Morsi is an intermediary with al-Qaeda.
A final question here. Help us understand for the Christians in Egypt, under the new security apparatus, under the control of the army, are they better off? Should we be concerned about Egypt 1, 2, 3 years down the road with the military still in power?
Well, it really comes down to, you know, what's ideally a democracy, freedom. And see, this is the issue. People aren't understanding. For example, today, Brotherhood's ousted, but you have the Salafis who are very much, informing the substance of the Constitution of Egypt, which will immediately, as a lot of cops are complaining, is inherently discriminatory towards them and other non-Muslims. So, you know, the problem that the cops are suffering does not begin nor does it end with the Muslim Brotherhood. And now we go into a deeper, you know, more theological, historical topic. But the Muslim Brotherhood is feeding off of it, is exploiting this sort of thing, and is using it to make it worse. So, long story short, Egypt and the cops are better off without the Muslim Brotherhood. They are better. They'd be better with the military, which is, of course, not ideal by any means. But in comparison to what you had, which is basically under the guise of a democracy, an Islamist organization that, you know, is enforcing Sharia and all and the Islamic agenda, then you're better off with the military. At least, and look, Egypt's been run. run by autocrats and dictators and pharaohs for almost for 5,000 years. So it's okay if you have, if you've got to wait a little, a couple of years to transition into a true positive secular, you know, democracy, and even if it takes a little longer than it needs to or should.
You talked real quickly about the Salafis and the influence that they have. Just today, there was a report talking about the evangelical leader who is part of the Constitution, writing of the Constitution, threatening to pull out because of this issue of Sharia law and whether Islam will be the principle underguiding the Constitution. Are you concerned that the writing of the Constitution will basically say that Islam is the principal law of the land?
Well, that's what it comes down to. This is the number one concern of not just Copts, by the way, but a lot of ordinary average Egyptians, you know, nominal Muslims, moderate Muslims, whatever you want to call them. And so it's become a focal point. And again, this also, you know, violence and the incitement, but by pushing for this sort of, Islam-heavy constitution, that in and of itself is a form of persecution of non-Muslims, and that's what all these groups are aware of, and that's why they're trying to fight it. And so it's very, you know, volatile time, and there's a lot of changes that will be happening in the near future, and it's interesting to see how they'll develop.
Okay, Rayman Ibrahim, sir, thank you so much for bringing this important story to life.
Thank you, George.
I thought that was great.
It was a good explanation, I thought.
To understand what's really going on over there, you know.
I didn't realize how deeply we were involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, Obama, I've been reading articles on this continually. And
I knew we were involved.
His brother.
But I didn't realize his
Malik,
brother.
Malik. Oh, my God, he's a crook as hell.
He's a crook.
But he's a crook because Obama is feeding him the money, and he's going in and giving the money to the Muslim Brotherhood. Anyway, you know what's interesting? Excuse me. Joseph Mengele once said, "The more we do to you, the less you seem to believe we are doing it." That is so true. The more that they do to us, the less we believe they're doing it. It's like, you know, we can't believe this.
I was reading on the David Icke site about all the surveillance. They have new things going in. These big boxes they're putting on poles in Seattle.
Yeah.
Big white boxes.
That's amazing.
And they're already in lots of cities.
Yeah, they're just there to surveillance you. And pick up
all Wi-Fi.
Conversations, Wi-Fi. I mean, it's just unbelievable. You know what? Maybe we should take a little minute break.
Okay.
So we'll play a little music and come right back. Yeah, it's really crazy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Thank you. Hello. And I'm going to want to read something. We're going to read a little health stuff tonight. I think it's really interesting. Of course, everybody knows by now that FDA declared fats no longer safe to eat. Okay, partially hydrogenated fats. That's the ban. Well, that's a good thing. But did you know that raw organic fruits and vegetables can cure cancer? So why don't oncologists tell their patients that? Isn't that interesting?
There is a 75-year con known as Western medicine, but it's a hush-hush topic in the news and in newspapers and magazines. Although medical doctors and surgeons are experts at fixing broken bones or removing animal fat from clogged arteries, the pharmaceutical nation known as the USA is caving in on itself because nobody is allowed to talk about it on TV or they lose all their sponsors. There is also a world of medicine known as organic food, but some people want to cook it, fry it, or boil it, or broil it, or even worse, grill it out, and that live food becomes dead food and useless to the body, which needs nutrients for immunity, cellular health, vitality, and sustainability.
Hmm. Is there a cancer industrial complex in the USA? So why don't oncologists talk about raw foods, which are full of nutrients, oxygen for the cells, the cure for cancer, and a raw regimen when people are on their deathbeds or are sent home to die with pancreatic cancer, liver cancer, or cancer of some other organ that you can have to save,
that you have to survive.
When cancer spreads to the lymph nodes or the spinal column, why don't doctors, surgeons, and oncologists tell their patients about these raw foods that give them the best chance of a recovery? And I mean permanent remission and recovery. Are these Western medicine practitioners evil, money-grabbing cons, or are they just ignorant, miseducated, and unknowing?
Mm-hmm.
How could that be? How could you be trained to do surgery or read lab results and not know one thing about nutrition?
They don't.
Do some of them know but are not saying anything? Their income would drop to about 25% of what they make now using dangerous chemicals to treat a chemical-driven disease? No oncologist in the world suggests medicinal mushrooms and takes a big guess why. The answer to every one of the questions above is to just listen to the people who do know about raw foods and can tell wonderful stories about their recovery from deadly cancers and why they chose nutrition over chemo, surgery, and radiation. Then learn from honest souls who share their most personal journeys to the past and past the cons of the cancer industrial complex. Consider the fact that even scientists have found a natural cure for cancer, and people testify in courts that it works, even for children and the terminal cancer. Natural News has a few other heartwarming stories about the real people who survived lethal cancer and live to share their stories with the world. Jake Cordish, known as the father of vegetable juicing, says raw foods are responsible for overcoming his own bladder cancer. One of his followers, John Kohler, has been on a raw food diet since 1995, primarily enjoying juices. Not only did he survive his spinal meningitis, but he also lost weight and is living life more healthy than ever before.
Put it this way, if you were getting sick from moldy bread, would you look for a cure from a vaccine or medicine or consider surgery while you keep on eating more moldy bread every day? It's not that hard to filter chemicals from your daily intake. Check out Fugicate, the free phone app that scans the barcodes of foods and drinks and tells you if it's a GMO and rates it for quality. Oh, that's
Food,
a good thing.
Yeah, Fugicate, Fooducate.
.com.
Yeah.
Check out great raw food regimens. naturalnews.com. 1.5 million people every year fight cancer and need to know about raw foods, and we could end this search for the cure that the masses are conned into believing is worthwhile. The cure is here. The cure lives in nutrition. Appreciate the fact that If you don't eat cancer, it doesn't eat you.
There you go, folks. So don't eat cancer. Now here's something interesting. Another one. Nigella sativa is cancer's worst nightmare.
Hmm. Oh, Nigella sativa.
Yeah. Much to the dismay of many pharmaceutical giants and doctors who rebate checks from recommending chemotherapy treatments, Nigella sativa has been proven over and over again to successfully treat cancer without the use of conventional treatments. Nigella sativa has been shown to be effective against numerous cancers such as pancreatic, colon, prostate, breast, and even brain cancers. Indeed, Nigella sativa is cancer's worst nightmare and a ray of hope for our people who may have died otherwise.
Oh.
Statistics show that the success rate of people using chemotherapy over a 5-year period is only 2.1%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Nigella sativa, on the other hand, has proven to annihilate pancreatic tumor cells at the rate of 80%. Chemotherapy has made side effects, and one of the side effects is the possibility of secondary cancers. Well, secondary cancers are very aggressive and they occur from tumor receding.
Nigella cell
sativa
not only rebuilds the immune system and destroys cancer cells, it reinforces the good cells to fight the cancer. Needless to say, it is imperative to treat the cancer patient immediately or in the early stages if possible. Along with taking the oil, a cancer diet must be followed. Sugar, processed foods, and white flours only feed the cancer and can make the cancer fight much more difficult.
And I did not know sugar, processed foods, and white flours. Cancer studies in Nigella sativa. Presently, there are 462 published studies on the
efficacy
of sativa. There have been multiple studies on the effect of Nigella sativa and its anti-tumor capabilities. In 1997, at the cancer research facility at Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, Nigella sativa was proven to have enormous capabilities in tumor cell death.
Pancreatic cancer. A study was done at Kimmel's Cancer Center at Jefferson, and the researchers found that by adding Nigella sativa, 80% of pancreatic cancer cells were destroyed. Pancreatic cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer death in America, with only a 4% survival rate after 5 years using conventional treatment. Colon cancer. In 2010, a research project was conducted in Panta, Egypt, on the use of Nigella sativa against colon cancer in rats. Nigella sativa greatly reduced the size of the tumors and also reduced the tumors in the lungs and the alimentary canal. Breast cancer. In 2003, researchers from Jackson State University in the U.S. tested Nigella sativa on breast cancer cells. Ending results showed promising advances in the treatment of breast cancer. There are many success stories using Nigella sativa against cancer, and how each protocol worked for the individual, such as the boy who took 9 capsules a day of the Bacumen oil, Nigella sativa, for brain cancer. Nigella sativa cancer protocol. The Nigella sativa cancer protocol is quite simple and very effective. Take 3 teaspoons of the oil a day, mixed with a 1/2 teaspoon of raw honey or a freshly squeezed juice. Take the first dosage half in an hour before breakfast, the second one in the afternoon, and the third dosage before going to bed. An alternative dose of protocol is to use ground heated seeds once a day and oil twice a day. Simply mix the ground seeds with raw honey and eat as you would any sweet treat.
Well, there you go, folks. There's enough. So that cures cancer.
Hmm.
You don't need pharmaceuticals to do that. Vaccine fraud exposed. Measles and mumps making a huge comeback because vaccines are designed to fail. Imagine that.
Huh. planned obsolescence. Like cars or washing machines?
Designed to fail, says Merck Virologist.
That's why you have to get more?
Yeah. Disclaimer, this guy says, this naturalist. I'm not an opponent of the theory of inoculation, nor am I opposed to science. What I'm opposed to is fraudulent science, and that's what this article is about. Measles and mumps are making a huge comeback in the United States.
I didn't realize that, did you?
No, but doctors and journalists all make the same critical error in understanding why. They blame parents who don't vaccinate their kids as the cause, but the real cause, as revealed by whistleblowing scientists working for top vaccine manufacturers, is that measles and mumps vaccines are designed to fail from the start. Scientific fraud, it turns out, is an inherent part of the vaccine industry. How do we know? Because whistleblowers who worked in the industry have found the courage to speak out and tell the truth. These people are the Edward Snowdens of the vaccine industry. Merck falsified its mumps vaccine efficacy results, say former employees. Merck knowingly falsified its mumps vaccine test results to fabricate a 95% efficacy rate. I'll let you say that. He's kind of comes up. Saying former Merck virologist in their shocking False Claim Act document. As I wrote last year, in order to do this, Merck spiked the blood test with animal antibodies in order to artificially inflate the appearance of immune system antibodies.
Wow.
Yeah. From the False Claim Act complaint, Merck also added animal antibodies to blood samples to achieve more favorable test results, though it knew that the human immune system would never produce such antibodies, and that the antibodies created a laboratory testing scenario that did not in any way correlate with or represent real life. Virus neutralization in vaccinated people, according to the complaint. Merck, of course, denies the claims, just like all the drug companies deny ever engaging in bribery,
right,
using children for medical experiments or ghostwriting scientific studies that get published in science journals, or conspiring to suppress competing generic drugs, and so on. Yet, as history has shown, all the top drug companies are routinely engaged in widespread criminal behavior, including conspiracy, fraud, bribery, and more. Stephen Kratling and Joan Wachowski are simply telling us that we already suspect that Merck falsifies the efficacy of their vaccines in order to make them appear to be working when they actually aren't. Why would a drug company do such a thing? Well, consider the fact that Merck has both motive and opportunity. Why drug companies design vaccines to fail? The vaccination dogma is so deeply embedded in the minds of doctors, journalists, and the public that any time a communicable disease starts to spread, everybody immediately leaps to the false conclusion that more vaccines are needed.
Yeah.
This is very nearly a Pavlovian reaction in the minds of the brainwashed masses. Spread of disease equals lack of vaccines. Thus, the spread of disease actually boosts vaccine sales. All right? The epidemics are a marketing tool to create demand for a profitable product that people can be convinced to purchase over and over again, year after year, whether it works or not. And how do you create that demand? You engineer an epidemic by making sure your own vaccine products don't work. And fear drives people to get vaccinated.
Fear.
So fear is used as the primary marketing tool. But why hasn't the con been exposed yet? Why haven't scientists announced that most of the children afflicted with measles and mumps are the very same children who were vaccinated? And one study shows that 97% of children afflicted with mumps already had been vaccinated against mumps.
What?
In 2010, a mumps outbreak spread in New Jersey, and 77% of children afflicted with mumps had already been vaccinated against the mumps. The same is true with measles. Most measles outbreaks spread among those who have been vaccinated against measles. when a swine flu outbreak swept through Britain in 2010, okay, it turns out that 70% of those infected had already had been vaccinated against the swine flu, far from protecting people from disease outbreaks. Vaccines often promote the pandemic they claim to prevent.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Really sick crap.
Sure is.
Some vaccines are actively spiked with live viruses to cause the pandemic.
Oh my God.
The Natural News previously exposed the vaccine industry was caught shipping live viruses to vaccine manufacturers of flu vaccines in 18 countries. This was done by none other than Baxter International, one of the top suppliers of weakened flu virus material for uses in vaccines. Except in this case, they weren't weakened. Vaccines made with this material simply gave people...
Yeah, remember a lot of people complained about they get the flu shot and they
seem
to get
the flu. I got that one year and I got the flu and I never had another flu shot and I don't think I've had the flu since. In the realm of desktop computing, many people believe that antivirus companies write and release viruses in order to cause fear and boost demand for their products. It is an incredibly effective way to sell more products. All you have to do is pay a group of hackers a couple of million dollars to keep writing viruses that get covered in the mainstream media. The scarier the story, the more people buy antivirus software. I happen to know firsthand that McAfee uses dishonest scare tactics to sell their security software services, claiming your website is infected when it actually isn't. So vaccine companies, it turns out, use the same tactic. From time to time, they allow the live viruses into the flu shots, thereby spreading influenza and causing the very kind of fear and panic that drives people to pharmacies to buy more vaccines. Well, the WHO and the CDC are all part of it, too, stirring up irrational fear and panic like they did with the H5N1 virus a few years ago.
Remember that?
It turns out that WHO, the HWO panel members received kickbacks from drug companies to engineer the anti-science scare stories. Man. And during the swine flu pandemic, it was revealed that 5 of the 15 members of a WHO advisory panel had financial ties to the very same drug companies who would financially benefit from the pandemic. That's called conflict of interest in any other industry. If for some reason it is fully tolerated in the fraudulent vaccine industry.
I guess so.
In 2010, an outstanding article by Dr. Gary Null explained much of this in excruciating detail. Read that article on Natural News. The deeper you dig into vaccine industry, its long-standing practice of scientific fraud, misrepresentation, fear-mongering, and medical false flags, the more you realize just what a total con the vaccine industry has become.
And we've all been taken advantage of.
Anyway, that's about it. And we're right at the end of our show.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I wanted to show you is a wonderful article, you get it at awakening.com. And it's about plants exhibit the same
senses as humans.
I thought that was a remarkable thought. Plants exhibit the same senses as humans and see, touch, smell, hear, and taste. And even taste.
Have you ever wondered what the grass under your feet feels? What an apple tree smells? Or a marigold sees? Plants stimulate our senses. Excuse me. Constantly. Yeah, I can't.
You can't do it.
Excuse me.
I don't know what's the matter. But plants stimulate our senses constantly, but most of us never consider them as sensory beings. In fact, senses are extremely important to plants. Whatever life throws at them, they remain rooted to the spot. They cannot migrate in search of food, escape a swarm of locusts, or find shelter from a storm. To grow and survive in unpredictable conditions, plants need to sense their environment and react accordingly. So Some people may not be comfortable describing what plants do as seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, but they certainly lack noses, eyes, ears, mouths, and skin. But in that, in what follows, I hope to convince you that the sensory world of plants is not so very different from our own. It's 9 o'clock, and I'm going to direct you to this.
It's a great article from the Waking Times. It's very good. I enjoyed it.
Because
I do talk to my plants.
Waking Times.
I do talk to my plants.
Yeah, well, they're a lot of plants. She talks and sprays them every day.
Yeah, they love it. You know, little lips,
yeah,
little
leaves. Yeah, she's got a beautiful outdoor garden, too. So, you know.
Excuse me.
She's got a cool.
Yeah,
so
unfortunately.
I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. And wish you the best.
Yeah,
and
take care, folks,
tomorrow,
and have a good
night. Thank you.